We'll have to do a quick recap. Because I wanted to pick up a little bit of where we left off. So let's try to do a quick recap. Essentially what we started to explore was the concept of Tzelem Elokim. Because if the Rambam defines the third principle as the negation of any kind of physicality to God, the notion that Eino Guf, that Evlo Masigeu Masigeu Guf, that he's not physical and nothing physical can apply to him, no physical concept can comprehend him. So if God is a total negation of anything physical, the challenge is obviously the question of the notion that God has created the human being in the image of God. What is the image of God if not some kind of physical image that we reflect and that we share in common with God? So we look at several possibilities. The Rambam himself defines the concept of Tzelem Elokim as a reflection of the intellect of the human being. What is common to all of the opinions that we looked at and that we're going to explore today is that the notion that Tzelem Elokim means the exact opposite of what we normally refer to it as. We normally translate Tzelem Elokim as the image of God, and therefore assume that there has to be some image in which man is created. All the Mefarshim understand the concept of Tzelem Elokim in the exact opposite, that it is not God who looks like us, but the human being who carries within him a component of non-physicality that we get from God. That every other aspect of the animal kingdom essentially is developed through the creation of the physical universe. Only the human being is endowed with a duality to him, the physical and a spiritual side, or a non-physical side, a godly side. And it's that side of him, unique to the human being, that is called Tzelem Elokim. That's essentially the broad stroke answer to the question. Now we can break it down. Wherein lies that aspect of the non-physical, what we call the soul, or the neshama, or the ruach, or the nefesh, all kinds of different terminologies that are used in Kabbalistic writings for it, but essentially where does it lie? So the Rambam defines the source of that non-physical component of the human being as the intellect, the human being's ability to comprehend the infinite, to comprehend to the best of our ability the divine. Our ability to talk about God, to grasp a concept of God as best we can, to grapple with the ideas, to abstract the thinking, that, says the Rambam, is clearly beyond the physical realm. We are engaged in a process that borders the non-physical. That's that thought, that intellect, that mind is the neshama. And that's why the Rambam develops in a number of different arenas, both in Hilchot Yesodei Torah and in the Maor Nevuchim, and in many of his philosophical works, the importance of intellectual development as the culmination of the greatest achievement of the human being. It's a person who wants to achieve the greatest perfection humanly possible would strive to develop the intellect, the mind. Because to the Rambam, that's where the soul is housed. Borrowing much from an Aristotelian mindset or mindset that is common to much of Greek philosophy, with it's the intellect that defines the essence of a human being, the Rambam uses that idea to develop the notion of Tzelem Elokim. That's essentially one direction. The second direction that we all suggested is that the Tzelem Elokim is that of the Sforno, and the Sforno suggests that the concept of Tzelem Elokim lies in the human being's ability to make choices and to act based on choice, abstract, logical, free choice, non-coerced choice, rather than acting on instinct alone. Whereas every other creature essentially acts upon the instincts that are part of nature, the human being alone has the ability to make choices that run contrary to their own instinct, because they're able to use their ability to choose and the power of choice to override that instinct. And that's what we mean when we refer to free choice. free, meaning free of the physicality, free of the laws of the physicality, of the physical world, free of coerced or compelled action or predictable action. The unpredictability, the non-predictability of it is what makes the human being so unique. Svarno talks about the notion of po'alim b'di'al b'hakara, the ability to act, to engage in activity with full knowledge and awareness. U'b'ktzat yidameh adam le'elokim yitbarach ha'po'el b'b'chira. It's the similarity to God that we share is the ability to function in a free environment and to make choices, right, wrong, objective, value choices, choices of self-sacrifice, choices that clearly run contrary to the instincts of the physical universe and the beast within us. So that's essentially where we left off. The notion, two classical formulations of what this, the notion of the soul, of the neshama, or the tzelem elokim. The Rambam, who defines it as the ability to think, and the Sforno, who defines it as the ability to choose. Both of which share the notion that the soul, that the tzelem elokim, reflects the non-physical component of the human being, exactly the opposite of how we would otherwise translate tzelem elokim, which would seem to imply a physicality. We are created in the image of God. It's quite the opposite. We are created in the non-image of God, if you will, the non-physical. I even suggested to you, and this is sort of where we left off last week, that there is a much better definition of the phrase Tzelem Elokim is found in R.A. Kaplan's translation. Because in English, words mean very different things than they do in Hebrew. The Rambam goes to great length to show that the word Tzelem in biblical Hebrew means something very different than it does in medieval Hebrew. Medieval Hebrew, and even modern Hebrew, Tzelem is a form, is a picture, an image. Whereas in biblical Hebrew, Tzelem or Demut refers not to the form of something, but to the essence of something, that which is untangible and undefinable, that which defines the core being. Whereas the term for image or external reflection would be to'ar. And so somebody who is beautiful is yefei to'ar, whereas somebody who shares a certain characteristic with something else that is in the core of it, not in the physical form, but in the essence of what it stands for, is domelo, is similar to it. And therefore you have term, when we talk about God, we talk about Tzelem Elokim or Bidmut, Na'aseh Adam Bitzalmenu Kidmutenu. You have the Tzelem and the Dmut in comparison to God, not the Tor. The Tor is reserved for physical things alone. So I.A. Kaplan retranslated the phrase Tzelem Elokim to reflect this notion. And he calls it man who is created in the image of godliness, which I think is actually much more powerful. Sorry, in the spirit of godliness, tzelem elokim in the spirit of godliness. I think he even said that. Does he say spirit of godliness or image of God? And I think he says spirit. We have a translation here.
Last week he said spirit.
I think I did say spirit. Moment doubting myself, so we're gonna. That's what happens when you make a mistake. You begin to doubt yourself. Interesting. Okay. I stand doubly corrected. Stand doubly corrected. He doesn't translate it differently here, so it must have been in one of his other books that I picked it up from. Because here he translates it as image of God. but I remember seeing that translation in one of his writings, so it must have been in a different book. He talks in a footnote here about what image and likeness mean, but he does not put the but the retranslation of "in the spirit of godliness" must appear in another one of his books, not in here. So I stand doubly corrected. It is the spirit of godliness, and that's the translation that I like to use because I think it reflects the notion that we're trying to convey. That's where we sort of left off at the end of last week. Agreed? What I wanted to add as a postscript to that discussion is really a discussion of what role this neshama or tselem elokim plays in our lives. What's the purpose, in the sense of having this tselem elokim? How do we understand its role in relationship or as part of the relationship between man and God? Clearly, I think it's significant enough that it is the climax of the whole creation process. If we look at the story of the Bria, the story of the Bria culminates in this notion that the human being alone amongst all of that which is created has within him this notion of Tzelem Elokim, described in Perek Aleph as just that, Tzelem Elokim, described in Perek Bet in greater elaboration, where you have this creation of the human being out of physical dust of the earth, into which God blows through the nostrils, blows the spirit of life. So clearly it's a fundamental part of the story of creation. It appears twice, both in Perek Aleph and in Perek Bet. It is the beginning of the process of the creation of the human being, of the creation of the world. And there is really one primary source which I really find very compelling as sort of a cornerstone of understanding as to this whole dilemma. What is the neshama? What is the soul? And how does it operate? The Rambam, in his introduction to these 13 principles, discusses this idea in much greater length. I couldn't find a specific paragraph in which to pull out a quote, so I'm going to digest it for you, sort of distill for you the basic idea that the Rambam conveys. The Rambam doesn't quote this Medrash, but I think it is actually reflected in this Medrash as well. If you take a look at source number 3, source number 3 is a very famous, well-known Midrashic story of the creation of every baby, the birth of every baby, the introduction of the soul. Specifically, you all know the story of the Malach that comes to teach every baby Torah in its mother's womb from beginning to end, and then just before the baby is born, the Malach gives it a zetz, afmponim, gives him a patch right there in the cheek, on the upper lip, and he forgets everything that he ever learned. And of course, the obvious question is, what is the possible value of teaching the baby the Torah if you're going to cause him to forget it all immediately? Nonetheless, that's the Medrash. That Medrash is the beginning of this Medrash Tanchuma. Its source is this quote, source number 3. I left out that piece of it because it's not germane to our discussion, but that's, if you looked up the Medrash, you'd find that whole piece about the Malach going to the baby and teaching it Torah from start to finish is actually the continuation of this Medrash. In source number 3, the piece that I wanted to look at is the following. Miyad holecha malach umevi taruach lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is the process by which every child comes into the world. The Malach goes and brings the Ruach before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Ruach, referring to some kind of spiritual entity that will then be imbued into the human being. In other words, the assumption in the Medrash is that process that Adam HaRishon went through, where the Torah describes Adam HaRishon as a combination of physical and spiritual, afar min adama, combined with Ruach Elokim or Tzelem Elokim, is actually the process that every human being goes through in the birth process. The physical baby developed from the process of procreation, and into that person is imbued the Ruach. Much of modern medical ethics revolves around the question of what exact moment this process takes place. the field today of the controversy over stem cell research and over abortion and over scientific research fertility treatment, all of those components of medical ethics today, and the positions of theological positions of the Catholic Church, rabbinate, of the various different denominations and religions, revolves around this question. At what point does this ruach enter this person? What we would call, what in the terminology of the medical ethics, religious medical ethics, has become known as ensoulment. And that's the term that's used, and the doctors here are shaking their heads, yes, yes, yes. Right? That's the great debate. At what soul what point does ensoulment take place? From our vantage point, that question is resolved simply by the fact that we do not like to mix halachic material with midrashic material. Midrashic material has its philosophical role and ethical role. Halachic material dictates our actions. And so the halachic position may in fact be somewhat different than this midrashic position. That wouldn't necessarily be a challenge for us. Miad halech malach mevi et ruach lifnei kadosh baruch hu. The malach goes and brings this ruach before God. Ukeshehi ba'a, when this ruach comes, miyad korat umishtachava lifnei melech malchei hamelachim kadosh baruch hu. Immediately the soul, kaviyochel, in some sort of format, prostrates itself before God, bows down, and describes, in a sense, throws herself at the mercy of the court. At that moment, Kadosh Baruch Hu says to this ruach, "He can see b'tipa zu shebiyad ploni. I want you to enter into this drop that is inside this person." Clearly referring to the moment of conception, fertilization, which is why I said that you cannot derive halachic conclusions from this medrash, mm-hmm. because halachically we do not position our concept of ensoulment at the moment of conception.
Why do you say the tipa is at that moment? That we call it until 40 days, it's tipa, srucha, whatever. It's the whole thing for many days is considered a tipa.
Maya Ba'alma, I'm not sure if the word tipa would be used for that later stage. I think tipa sruf is usually, as far as I know, is usually referred specifically to the moment or the pre-moment of fertilization, but I could be mistaken. If it is, then that's fine. Either way, it wouldn't bother me because from a halacha point of view, we don't derive halacha from medrash, but from midrash agadah. But nonetheless, let's go back to the issue here. So the Ribbono Shel Olam turns to this soul and says, "I want you to enter into this person." But this person is described as, in its present physical state, as a tipa, as a drop, because that's what it is. Patach haruach piv v'omer. The ruach opens up its mouth and begins to speak. And it says before God, Ribbono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Dai, now listen carefully, Dai li ha'olam shehayiti dar miyom shebaratani. It is sufficient for me to remain in the world in which you have put me from the moment of my creation. I'm quite satisfied where I am. I don't want to enter into this tipa srucha. I am very happy here. I'm very comfortable here. I'm very satisfied. Now listen to the phrase. The phrase is dai li. Dai means dayenu. Dai means it's enough. Now, dayenu is an interesting word. I would expect the ruach to say something like yefeli, I like it here.
Where is here?
In the world, in the world of the souls, in the world of God, I like it here. It's comfortable here. I'm enjoying myself here. Of all the things that you could say, the irony of Daili, it's enough for me, it's sufficient for me, sounds like, even though I know that what I have right now is not ideal, it's not great, it's not perfect, but it is satisfactory. That's a strange way to describe the world of the neshama. The world of the neshama is where every person is destined to go back to. Are we saying that every person, that the destiny after 120 years is to go back to a world which is described as daily? It's okay, I can live with it, it's sufficient. We talk about Olam Haba as a world of the greatest pleasure, if you can describe it in that sense, and the greatest achievement, to describe that world of pure soul and pure spirit as a world of Daili, it's enough. I don't need more. Sounds very strange. And yet that's exactly what the Ruach says.
Does that have anything to do with the concept of if you go into the human being, you can be perfected?
Well, we're going to get there in a moment. That's where we're going. Hang on a second. That's where the Rambam takes it, certainly. Lama ritzoncha, not only that, lama ritzoncha lachnisani betipazu slucha. Why is it that you want to put me into this? Not only does God described it as a tipa, as a drop, the neshama describes it as a tipa sucha, meaning a putrid drop. Insufficient that it's just a drop. Now there's an editorial comment about how putrid it is. Sha'ani k'dusha'u tehora. I, the Ruach says, am holy and pure. And I am an extension of you. I am an extension of your kavod. I am an extension, essentially, of you, the Ribbono Shel Olam. What in Kabbalistic terminology we call the chelek eloka mimal, a portion of the Ribbono Shel Olam, a portion of God. I am derived from you, kadosh and tahor, and you want to put me into this, not only a tipa, but a tipa srucha. Yad Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu L'Neshama. So immediately a Kadosh Baruch Hu turns, says to the Neshama, and you see here in this passage alone that the use of Ruach and Neshama are interchangeable. That was what the Rambam referred to last week when he said that the terms Ruach, Neshama, and Nefesh are often used interchangeably without a consistent pattern, and therefore don't hold anybody to the exact usage of one term over another, but rather the general concepts are referred to. Miad Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu L'Neshama, Olam She'ani Machnisech Bo, Yafe Yehelach Mima Shehayit Dar Bo. The world into which I am placing you, it will be more beautiful for you than the world in which you would have lived. U'bishah She'yitzartich Lo Yitzartich Ela L'Tipazu. And from the moment you were created, you were only created for the purpose of going into this tipa. I'll stop here. I'll read the next five words in a minute. What's the Ribbono Shel Olam's answer? How many answers does the Ribbono Shel Olam give to the neshama?
Two.
And they're very different. What's the difference between them? In format, what's the difference between them? Not in substance, but just in form. One is an attempt to convince, and the other is essentially an argument of...
It's a command.
You have no choice. The first answer, the world in which I am placing you will be more beautiful for you than the world in which you would have been, is an attempt essentially to convince the soul. This is good for you. It's better for you. It will achieve more for you. It will achieve a status called Yafe Yehelach. It will be beautiful for you, good for you, whatever that means. Why, we will explore in a moment. But there is a positive outcome out of this which will be better for you in the long run. And certainly compared to the Olam Shehayit Darba, the world in which you would have remained, the world in which you would have lived is the world of pure neshama. The fact that I have placed you into this world, I'm going to place you into this world of physicality, is for your benefit in some way. We will define that in a moment. And then the Rebbeinu Shlomo employs a second argument, namely, the second argument is, I didn't ask for your opinion. I didn't ask, do you or don't you want? I gave you a mission. I created you for a mission. You may like it here, but in the meantime, you have a mission because I put you into this world to achieve that mission. And you don't, therefore, have a choice. The conclusion of the Medrash is, Miyad machniso HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'sham ba'al korcho. Immediately, Rebbeinu Shlom places the soul into the tipa against its will. Which means that existentially, remember, this is the Medrash describing the process that every neshama goes through. Not a story of a neshama of an individual. This is the existential plight of every soul. Rebbeinu Shlom says the Medrash places the soul into the body, ba'al korcho, against its will. In other words, at the end of the day, the soul remains unconvinced. Unconvinced. Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai argued for 3 years whether it would better for man to have been created or not created. Familiar with the Talmudic debate? The famous debate in the Gemara between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. Whether Tov li barot, whether it's good for man to have been created or not good for man to have been created.
They wouldn't have been arguing if it was.
They spent 3 years arguing that point. And in the end, their determination and conclusion was better not to have been created. But once we're here already, so you have to spend your time engaged in Torah, Masim, Tovim, because that's what we're here for. Fascinating debate. Conclusion, logical, philosophical conclusion of 3 years of debate was exactly the same conclusion that this neshama came to before the Rebbeinu Shlom put it into the world. It's better not to be here in the first place. Better not to have been created. But once we're here, so we have a challenge. Rebbeinu Shlom had a different perspective on it. But that's the Medrash, yeah.
But if you weren't created, you wouldn't have had the opportunity to have the challenge.
If you weren't created, you wouldn't have had the opportunity to have the debate for 3 years.
Right.
So that's what Beis Hillel was saying, Ich bin Meichel sein on the challenge. I've been Meichel on the challenge and Meichel on the debate. Better not to have been created. Which is a fascinating and somewhat pessimistic view of the world. But the Torah's view and the Medrash reflecting that is the exact opposite, that whether we perceive logically, rationally or not, Rebbeinu Shlom had a different purpose. God created the world. We choose to say that it would have been better not to create the world is irrelevant. At the end of the day, he did create the world and he created the human being with the neshama, and now the question is, what's its purpose? So let's break this answer down into each part. Let's deal with the first part, and I think this is essentially what you were saying earlier about the challenge. The statement that Rebbeinu Shlomo makes, Olam Shahit Shani Machnisech Bo, Yafei Yehelach Mima Shahit Darbo, the world in which I put you, it will be better for you than the world in which you would have lived. Which world is the Rebbeinu Shlomo talking about? Okay, so let's work this through. There's Olam and Neshamot. Okay, Olam and Neshamot, that's where the soul is now. Comes down into the world of Olam HaTipa. The world of this Tipa, whatever we call it. Okay? Says the Medrash, says the Rebbeinu Shlom, Olam she'ani machnisech bo, the world in which I am putting you. Yefe yehelach, it will be more beautiful for you, mima shehayit darbo, from the world in which you would have lived. So what are we comparing?
The world here compared to the world.
The world here compared to the world there. And what is the Medrash suggesting? Which is better?
Here. That here is better than here.
Is that true? That the world of the tipa is better than the world of...
The Medrash is saying that's God's opinion. God's decision.
Unless you're transformed to a higher level back in the neshama world. Can I have a question? Do the neshamas... is there a concept that they know a lot of... For example, the neshama that was going to wind up in Hitler. Do me a favor. Don't send me. I don't need that.
No, they can't know in advance because if they know, because if they know in if they know in advance, the human being would have no choice. The principle of free choice means that every human being has the choice to end up a Hitler or a Moshe Rabbeinu. The choice is up to the human being, not up to God or up to any other.
Not up to the neshama. No, I'm going the wrong place.
No, because at that point there is no wrong place. There's only good. There's only potential for good or evil. There is no objective right or wrong at that moment. That's exactly what we're going to get. But look at the language. Olam shani machnisech bo yafe yehelach mima shehayit darbo. Had the Rebbeinu Shel meant that the world in which I'm placing you is better than the world in which you come from, it should have said, "Olam shemini machnisech bo yafe mi mashayit darbo." It's better. It's a better world. That's not what it says. It says, "Yafe yeheilach." It will be better for you than the world in which you were. Olam shehayit darba.
Where is that? Is that
right.
Olam neshamot or someplace else that he would have sent you if he didn't go here?
Says the Rambam. That's the sequence. The sequence is that the world of the neshamot is where the neshama starts, enters into the world in which we live today, the Olam HaTipa, but the Medrash is reflecting the fact that that is only the journey to reach back to the Olam HaNeshamot again. That journey, the process that that neshama takes, is to go from the world of the neshama to the world of the physicality, to the world back to the world of the neshamot, back to the world of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. And it is there that the Medrash says, the olam shani machnisech bo is not this world. It's the result of being in this world that ends up returning you to the world of the neshama, of the world of the neshama, that is yehelach, it will be better for you than the world of the olam ha-neshamot that you were in to begin with.
Does that imply that the neshama would be destroyed if it didn't go into
it? Well, that's where I don't know if it would be destroyed, but that's where the second answer comes in. It would have no purpose for being if it didn't go through this journey. But the question that the Rambam challenges, and the Rambam essentially is looking at it from a philosophical point of view, I like to anchor this in the Midrashic terminology because I think that's where it emanates from, but the Rambam discusses it from a philosophical point of view. What's the purpose of taking the neshama out of the world of the neshama, putting it into the world of the physical, only to return it to the world of the neshama again? What is the purpose of that journey? The journey that Kohelet describes as a futile cycle. And here the Rambam says, and this is an idea which is reflected in many Midrashei Chazal, that the neshama cannot develop, it cannot change, it cannot grow in the world of the neshama. In the world of spirituality, in the world that's not physical, there's no ability to go right or wrong, there's no challenge to it, and therefore there is no ability to grow. The best analogy that I like to use, and I've used this analogy often, is that neshama is essentially a muscle. And if we borrow the analogy from muscle development, we end up with a very similar parallel, namely that you cannot develop a muscle in the absence of resistance. Strength, a muscle grows by virtue of the resistance we put on it. And the more you push against it, and the more resistance it has, and the more you exercise it, and the more you strain it, and the more you challenge it, the stronger it gets. Well, essentially, that's what the neshama is. The neshama in the physical world is in an existence which is for itself a painful and challenging one. The challenge is to exercise the muscle. The challenge is to exercise the neshama. We spend a lifetime doing so in order to strengthen it. And then we return it to the world of the neshama, a very transformed, very different experience. Says the Rambam, that's what the concept here means. The olam she'ani machnisech bo, this journey, yafei yehelach, ultimately will be better for you. Mimashayit darbo, compared to where you were had you not gone through the journey at all. You would have remained a created potential neshama. Now that you've gone through the process of life and experience and strength, etc., then you have the ability to grow and ultimately then to return to a better position or a better existence. Now, here's the question. Is that always the case? By the way, what is the mechanism for that growth? What's the exercise routine?
We carry that analogy forward.
Studying Torah.
Right. Studying Torah, the Rambam builds much on the intellectual development, because for the Rambam, the neshama is housed in the intellect. But for essentially every perspective on whatever the position is that you hold as far as what Selam Elokim is, it's going to focus on that dynamic of what the Torah is all about, whether it be Torah learning, or whether it be the exercise of choice, according to the Sforno, who says that the neshama is housed in our ability to choose. So the more choices we make, right from wrong, good from evil, Torah and mitzvot versus not Torah and mitzvot, the more choices we have, the greater exercise we have for the neshama. Others say it's the whole exercise of mitzvot. Rav Kook built a notion, a theory around the notion of kedushat haChomer, sanctification of the physical. That the purpose of all the mitzvot is to take that which is physical that we have in this world and to elevate it in its status, to give it a spiritual plane, and to elevate it through the mitzvot. And that's why every mitzvah deals with some component of the physical world we live in. From the leather straps of our tefillin to the mitzvah of chesed, every mitzvah deals in some way with the reality of the physical world, and that's how we exercise the neshama, through trying to pull the spirituality out of everything that's physical. That was Cook's notion of kedushat haChomer. However you define it, it ends up in sort of in the same place, which is there's some component of the human being that's not physical. It's that component that we have to nurture and exercise while we're here, so that the neshama goes back to olam haneshamot stronger and more accomplished. What's the danger? Bad choices. The danger is, if I spend a lifetime exercising the neshama, I end up with a very strong neshama. If I spend a lifetime, what happens to a muscle if you don't use it?
Atrophies.
It atrophies. If I spend a lifetime not using the neshama, essentially building upon it generations and years of disuse and physicality and mass, what's going to happen to this neshama is it's essentially going to atrophy, potentially even die. And what's going to happen to the neshama then? So the neshama starts here. Okay, I can pull us back into the analogy and the metaphor of this medrash. The neshama starts here. The Rebbeinu Shlomo wants to put it into a world here in order for it to climb here. That's possibility A. What's possibility B? Behind door number one, I have the accomplishments of a lifetime of exercise of the neshama. And behind door number two, I have what happens if you ignore the soul, ignore the spirit, ignore the spirituality of the world, ignore the exercise of choice and the intellectual development and the choices of right and wrong. And we can go from, as you correctly pointed out before, the world of a Hitler, Yimach Shemo, to the world of a Moshe Rabbeinu. You're here. Rebbeinu Shlomo wants to put you here so that you climb to here or potentially sink to here. You agree? Fair deal? What are your chances? Is it a 50-50? It's a crapshoot.
Pardon the expression.
It depends if 50-50? You get to neshama.
Half of the to neshama? 50-50 chance, right or wrong? Good or evil?
Maybe there are more evil people in the world than good people.
3 years, but Shammai and Betul debated this issue. This, I think, is the issue that Hillel and Shammai debated for 3 years. What are the statistical possibilities in this world? Are the odds against us or for us? Is it better to have been created and therefore to reach that potential? Or is it better not to have been created because the odds are against us? Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai came to the conclusion that the odds are against us. The Neshama's conclusion? Against. How do I know? Because the Baruch Hashem has to force it into existence. To which the Baruch Hashem comes and says, gives its second argument. And the second argument is, you don't have a choice. Because you were put into this world for that purpose. You're put here for a reason. The second argument essentially says, it doesn't matter if the odds are against you. The potential outweighs the risk, even though it's not a 50-50 chance. Even though the deck is stacked.
Against you?
Even though the deck is stacked against you, even though the Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai clearly said that the chances are less likely than more likely, even though the Neshama says, I don't want to take that gamble, the Bnei Shlom says, I put you there for a reason. I created the world for that potential.
I think that's the reason why the angel first taught all the Torah and then kissed, because like in neuroscience, if you once knew something, even if you forgot it, when you start to learn it again, there's like a resonance. So it would, I think you have a little more chance than 50-50, because it should be that there's something in you that you were given that helps you to know that.
I agree with you 1,000% that's why the Medrash continues, because it's the next passage in the Medrash about how the Malach went and taught all of Torah to that little neshama, because it's trying to help it raise its stake or raise the odds. That is why we have mitzvot. That's where the concept of ribui mitzvot comes in. 613 mitzvot. Famous, another passage, another interpretation of the Rambam. He says, the pasuk says, Hashem chafetz leman tzidko yagdil Torah v'yadir. That the Ribbono Shel Olam, out of an act of love for his people, increased the number of mitzvot for his people. Laman tzidko, in order for them to achieve their righteousness, yagdil Torah v'yadir, he increased the number of mitzvot in the Torah. So the Rambam writes in his commentary on the Mishnah on that, says that the way you achieve this process, what the Rambam calls Yosher and Olam Haba, remember how the Mishnah starts. The Mishnah starts, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelek L'Olam Haba. Every Jew is a share in the world to come. That's how the Rambam got into this whole discussion in the first place, by trying to understand what Olam Haba means. So the Rambam writes, how do you enter that share in the world to come? By achieving, once in your lifetime, the performance of one mitzvah 100% correctly. If you perform one mitzvah once in your lifetime with all the right intent, with all the right kavanah, with all the right motives, and with all the right context, and with everything lined up exactly as it should be, the potential achievement for the neshama is so enormous that that's your ticket in. But, says the Rambam, the ability to do that is so remote and so rare that the Ribbono Shel Olam, in order to help us reach that goal, had to give us not 7 mitzvot as he gave to Bnei Noach, but 613 mitzvot to increase the chances of 613 opportunities so that once in my lifetime I might get one of them right. Have you heard that concept? Rambam's Perish HaMishnah. It's a fascinating idea. But all of that is in order to help increase our chances. To help balance out the stacked deck, if you will. I agree with you. The soul is unconvinced and remains unconvinced
Once it remains undesirable of the journey, to which Rabbeinu Shlom finally says, you don't have a choice. That's what it's all about. That's what I put you here for. That's why I created you. Machnisech machnis oto baal kocho.
Is the non-Jewish, I mean, I know there's no right answer to this, but the non-Jewish soul, is it taught Torah also? Or is it, do all souls by Jewish philosophy start the same way, and you lucked out, you got into Moshe Rabbeinu, and, you know, you didn't quite luck out, you got into Mugabe, or something, you know, I don't... do they all start out learning Torah? Or is
that's a good question. I don't have a good answer to that question, because I don't know. But I can tell you the following. The notion of Olam Haba, the notion of a spiritual destiny, if you will, is not unique to the Jewish people. In other words, we do not claim to have a monopoly on the soul or the goal or the achievement of the soul. What we claim is that we have a responsibility of Tayag Mitzvot, and a Gentile has a responsibility of Sheva Mitzvot. They live up to their responsibility, they can have a share in the world to come, and if we live up to our responsibility, then we can have a share in the world to come. The difference may be qualitative, not quantitative. In other words, the difference may be we don't know what Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelek L'Olam Haba means. Does it mean that every single person has the exact same share? It's a ticket in or a ticket out, you're at the ball or you're not at the ball? Or does it mean that your experience in Olam HaNeshamot is reflective of your experience here? That's how I think the Rambam understood it. And I'll tell you why I think the Rambam understood it that way. The Rambam defines Olam Haba as the existence of the soul after it leaves this world in a purely spiritual existence. And the world, the opposite of Olam Haba, he says, is the world of Karet. Karet means the neshama is cut off and dies, and physically and spiritually, the human being dies both physically and spiritually at the same time. A person who achieves such a degradation of the soul that they achieve the punishment of karet, the soul dies with the body, says the Rambam. When the neshama leaves this world not having achieved karet, or on the contrary, achieve olam haba, then it leaves this world and goes to a purely spiritual existence. What that experience is a direct reflection of the strength of the neshama after its years and experience here. So the greater the strength of the experience, the greater the neshama has been exercised here, the greater the experience for that neshama in the world of Olam Haba. So that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody has the same share of the same experience. It just means that our goal is to try to increase our experience, which is an eternal one, through the efforts of the short time that we have here. Yeah.
Why do we assume that everyone of the neshama starts at the same starting point?
We don't. We make no assumptions. Everybody rises a little bit from where... I don't know. They were getting into conjecture, and I have no idea how that works. Other than the fact that the simplest analogy for me to kind of understand it intuitively is the analogy of the muscle. So you start with raw material, and now you have to work with it. So, is everybody born with the same raw material as far as muscle is concerned? Maybe not. But that's already genetics, and that's physics, and... You know, that's not the world of the neshama, so I don't know if there's an absolute scale to begin with or not.
No, I'm just wondering if...
I don't know. It's a little bit too esoteric for my taste. But all right, we got a little Kabbalistic, I think, if you will, but nonetheless, I think it's important, and the fact that the Rambam himself, the great rationalist, spends half of his introduction to his 13 principles trying to understand this concept of the soul and how it works, and the notion that when the soul leaves this world, whatever it's achieved physically, whatever it's achieved in terms of trying to, our experience in this physical, finite world, trying to tune ourselves with the soul, trying to expand it, extend it, strengthen it through mitzvot, through Torah learning, through intellectual process, whatever we achieve, that's what we take with us. But if we don't achieve, that's what we take with us. And Amnon spends half his introduction trying to understand this concept, because it really is the cornerstone of not only his treatise of the 13 principles, but also this Mishnah of Koyis Vayesh Lam Chelek Lelam Haba. That's where it all started, in the discussion of that Mishnah. So, and I see it so connected to this notion of principle number 3, where the Rambam defines the notion that God is not physical, and by extension, therefore, we are not physical. Now go figure out how our non-physical dimension interrelates and connects us to the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that gets back to that relationship idea that we spoke about in the first principle, first two principles. That ultimately, the whole purpose of defining any attribute of God is in order to define how we relate to God. Even the notion that God is not physical has no purpose by in and of itself. Its value only in that it tells us more about us than it does about God. So that really brings our discussion of principle number 3 to a close. And I will take questions. And then Bezat Hashem, next week, we will start principle number 4, which is the Rambam's theory of relativity. Questions? All right. So the Rambam and Einstein is our discussion for next week. We'll have to brush up on our theories of quantum. But that's not relativity. That's the relationship between matter and energy. Relativity is a different issue. Relativity is about time. And our discussion next week is going to be about time. So we will meet next week at the same time to discuss the nature of time.
Relative time.
Relative time.